The headlines this hour. Iran warns that any unconstructive action at the upcoming IAEA Board of Governors meeting will be met with a strong response. Thousands of people in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil mourn a Palestinian woman killed by Israeli forces. And Russia says the U.S. is adding fuel to the fire by planning to supply Ukraine with advanced missile systems.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran has vowed a strong and proportionate response to any unconstructive action against the Islamic Republic at the upcoming Board of Governors meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said that those using a recent IAEA report on Tehran's nuclear activities as a political tool will be responsible for the ensuing consequences. Saeed Khatibzadeh made the comments after France asked Iran to immediately answer the agency's questions raised in the report about its past nuclear activities. Khatibzadeh said such comments are in line with psychological operations to exert pressure on Iran ahead of the Board of Governors meeting. He said the Israeli regime is behind anti-Iran rhetoric and propaganda. Iran condemns Germany and French statements over the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the statements as one-sided and unjustifiable. Saeed Khatibzadeh says Paris and Berlin should stop defending the vessels that violated the maritime norm and instead uphold legal proceedings based on international laws. German and French foreign ministries have separately criticized the seizure of Greek tankers, calling it a violation of international regulations. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the vessels on Friday. The incident came just days after Greece confiscated an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered it to the U.S. Iran slammed the move as a violation of international law and called for immediate release of the vessel and its cargo. Meanwhile, Greek environmental groups have condemned Athens for causing an oil spill during the transfer of Iranian oil. Palestinians hold a funeral for a woman killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil earlier in the day. The killing has drawn widespread condemnations. The Israeli forces fired tear gas and sound bombs at mourners, bidding farewell to Gufran Warasne. She was fatally shot near the Al-Arub refugee camp over an alleged stabbing attempt. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that Israeli escalation would increase Palestinians' adherence to resistance. The group's spokesman decried the murder of the 31-year-old Warasne as a terrorist act. Separately, the Islamic Jihad called for more national efforts to confront the regime's crimes. The Palestinian prime minister also slammed the killing and warned that Israel will be fully responsible for repercussions. Mohammad Shtai urged the international community to boycott the regime. Warasne was identified as a journalist released from an Israeli jail in April. Correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with an update on the Israeli shooting. She says the regime's soldiers could have stopped the Palestinian woman if there was a threat, but they fatally shot her without remorse.
The Israeli military claims that Gufran arrived at a semi-checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Arub refugee camp, and she was wielding a knife. This is the Israeli story. And just before she approached even the Israeli soldiers who were conducting, let's say, security search in the area, and in order to make sure that the roads are safety, because these roads are used by Israeli settlers, even if they are at the entrance to the Palestinian refugee camps and Palestinian towns. Immediately, one of the Israeli soldiers decided to shoot her with the live fire. According to the international law, and in case Israeli soldiers or any soldiers felt, threatened, they could use their fire to hinder the movement, let's say, so-called attacker. But in this case, they are claiming that she had a knife. They are claiming that she tried to approach them. And before even she arrived at the checkpoint, she opened fire at her to kill her, not to hinder her movement, to arrest her and question her to see if she was what she was going to do.
Pro-Palestinian professor was forced out of his job at the University of Bristol after the pro-Israel lobby accused him of being anti-Semitic, is vowing to continue advocating for Palestine. This after a new round of opposition emerged online, attempting to silence him for speaking out. Amina Taylor sat down with David Miller for a one-on-one after the latest round of attacks.
A leading scholarly critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians is speaking out after renewed attacks surface regarding his anti-Zionism work. The social media firestorm erupted after Dr. David Miller shared snippets of an episode of Palestine Declassified, where he's a co-host and co-producer, where the controversial Chabad-Lugovitz set was profiled. The Community Security Trust led the latest charge against Dr. Miller, saying they needed to provide specialized anti-terror training as a result of the charges of extremism leveled against the group.
As some people will know watching this, the Community Security Trust has for a long time tried to attack me and was involved in me being sacked from the University of Bristol. And my response to them specifically was to say, well, they have in their charitable objectives, their charity, that they should be educating people about extremism. So my view is that they should be educating the British public about extremist organisations like this one, regardless of whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Christian. But of course they don't and won't do that.
David Miller and his supporters are well aware that there's a coordinated campaign afoot, one that seeks to undermine and smear his name and reputation at every turn. But for Professor Miller, these attacks simply strengthen his resolve. These fresh attacks are the latest in a long line of smears that led to Professor Miller being removed from his post at the University of Bristol. A tribunal on the issue is slated to be held in 2023.
Those who speak up for Palestinian rights will be attacked by Zionist groups, Zionist lobbies, and it will be said that they are anti-Semitic. This is the weapon of choice which they use. But it's not only in the UK. There are numerous other examples in other countries, in Germany, in Austria, in France, in the US, in other countries too. That case, my case, other cases too, they are a sort of warning to other people. You know, don't do this. Don't speak up. Don't tell the truth as you see it, because this will happen to you. And, of course, that frightens many people. What's at stake is that you're not allowed to speak out about Palestine. And if you do, that they will come for you. And we see that, you've mentioned academics. Yes, it affects academics all across the country, but we also see it with other, in other areas. We see counsellors and popular music stars and a whole range of people being attacked.
Like others who've paid a high price for speaking out, Professor Miller refuses to be cowed and will continue fighting for justice for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
The Turkish president has once again threatened that his country will carry out a military offensive across the border in Syria. Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that Turkey will rid Tal Rifat and Membiş area in northern Syria of what he called terrorists, an indirect reference to Kurdish militants. He added that Ankara's planned operations will gradually continue in other parts of northern Syria. He said that the move is in line with Turkey's plan to establish a 30-kilometer security zone in Syria. Damascus has condemned Ankara's plan to establish the zone as an act of aggression and an extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. Russia has accused the United States of adding fuel to the fire by planning to supply Ukraine with advanced missile systems. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the U.S. action deliberate and on purpose. He said that such arms supplies don't encourage Kyiv to resume peace talks. The spokesman also noted that Washington is using Ukrainian lives in order to maintain its fight against Moscow. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with advanced rocket systems that can strike with precision at long-range Russian targets. This is part of an additional U.S. military aid worth $700 million, which the White House says is aimed at helping Ukraine at the negotiating table with Russia. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be being used to target and kill civilians.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbas people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
In Denmark, people are voting in a referendum on whether to scrap their country's decades-old policy of not joining the European Union's common defense policy. Denmark is the only EU member that has a so-called defense reservation and is not bound by the bloc's common security and defense policy. However, recent polls suggest that Danes will vote in favor of abolishing the existing norm. The referendum comes as more European countries have been seeking closer military ties and increasing their defense spending since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. In the latest example, Sweden and Finland have applied for NATO membership, whereas Germany has decided to release more than $100 billion to modernize its army. Russia widening its gas cuts to Europe. Denmark is the latest to see a halt in gas supplies in response to its refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The Danish energy company says it has been informed by Russia's energy giant Gazprom about its decision. That's the day after Gazprom turned off its supplies to the top Dutch trader. Denmark says, however, that it has stored enough gas could buy more from the European market. Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland, citing their failure to make payments in rubles. Moscow's measures come in response to a host of sanctions that the European Union has imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine. On Monday, the bloc also agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and slash Russia's largest bank from the SWIFT system. The new sanctions sent Brent crude prices soaring to $122 a barrel. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says that Europe will suffer more from the economic war that it has launched against Russia.
Well, it comes down to substance. Russia has material. It has trees. It has oil. It has gas. It has gold. It has food. It has fertilizer. It has the substance of life. Europe has nothing but credit systems and banking systems, and really credit doesn't matter when you have a war situation. The only thing that matters is material substance. So Europe is basing all of its policy on the hot air and the fantasy that it is it is essential, it is some sort of social hub that unites all of civilization, and it is not. Russia is faring far better than any other country. The ruble is at record highs. Half the world agrees with Russia. Only European countries do not. And that's really based on a vanity and a silly, soft, pacifist culture that has grown in Europe like a cancer because of the nanny state that the United States has imposed upon it. But if these countries are trying to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas, perhaps the best thing for Russia to do is to wean them off quickly by yanking the spigot out of their, out of their economies and letting them get to that place all the more faster. they really want to wean themselves off, Russia has no problem cutting them off tomorrow from every barrel of oil and every container of gas and sell it to China, sell it to India, sell it to South America, sell it to South Africa, sell it to other nations.
Moscow warns that the European Union sanctions on Russian oil will negatively affect the entire Europe, as well as the global energy market. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov issued a warning in response to a partial oil embargo by the EU targeting Russia's seaborne oil exports. Peskov said that Moscow is taking measures to minimize the effects of the sanctions approved on Monday. He added that Russia can reroute its oil exports and find alternatives. The EU's latest move is part of a measure to halt around 90% of Russia's oil sales to bloc members by the end of the year. The bloc has imposed 6 rounds of sanctions on Russia since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned that such bans will cause more troubles for the EU than Russia. China has conducted a combat readiness sea and air patrols around Taiwan in response to what it calls collusion between the United States and the self-ruled island. In a statement, the Chinese military has criticized the U.S. for supporting Taiwanese forces, warning that such measures would put the island into a dangerous situation. The statement says the Chinese forces will strengthen their readiness to foil actions by those supporting Taiwan's independence. China's maneuver comes one day after the Taiwanese president acknowledged about plans for cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, but the U.S. has increased its military and diplomatic ties with Taipei. President Joe Biden also angered China recently after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if it is attacked by China. Earlier, political analyst Anar Tangen joined us with his take on rising tensions between China and Taiwan.
Well, from Beijing's point of view, it's an obvious provocation by Washington. It's not only sailing warships up and down the Taiwan Straits, but it was, Joe Biden himself, who has 3 times now indicated that he would intervene on behalf of Taiwan in the event of any kind of armed hostilities. And also, you know, the increased arms sales. Tammy Duckworth, a senator, came to Taiwan for an unannounced visit. This is one of many that has occurred. These are all, in Beijing's view, deliberate provocations trying to test edge China into doing something. It's not clear what the U.S. hopes to gain by this, but right now, given this domestic situation in the United States, 77% of the population is concerned about inflation. Yet Biden continues to tout international politics.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
Limelight. Experts and gun control advocates caution that Canada's relatively strict laws do not fully shield it from violence of the kind that is rampant in the United States. A nation where hunting is common, Canada has one of the world's highest per capita gun ownership rates. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Leyland Sesso under the heading, Is the U.S. Gun Problem Becoming Canada's Gun Problem? Please stay tuned for more. On a spring evening in 2020, a gunman disguised as a police officer and armed with semi-automatic weapons began a shooting rampage in rural Nova Scotia that left 23 dead. Nova Scotia is one of the 13 provinces and territories of Canada. Days after the North American country's worst mass shooting, the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised swift action, announcing an immediate ban on about 1,500 makes and models of military-grade and assault-style weapons in the country. He said these weapons were designed for one purpose and one purpose only, to kill the largest number of people in the shortest amount of time. There is no use and no place for such weapons in Canada, adding, effective immediately, it is no longer permitted to buy, sell, transport, import, or use military-grade assault weapons in this country. Trudeau's actions prompted minimal debate and were met with relatively little political resistance. In contrast to the United States, where the latest mass shootings have once again highlighted the calcified nature of the gun control debate in the country, unwilling to confront weapons violence. But experts and gun control advocates caution that Canada's relatively strict laws do not fully shield it from violence of the kind that is rampant in the United States. A nation where hunting is common, Canada has one of the world's highest per capita gun ownership rates. According to the 2018 Small Arms Survey, there are an estimated 34.7 firearms per 100 people. But Canada still trails behind its southern neighbor, both in gun ownership rates and firearms-related incidents. Officials claim part of that is credited to a gun ownership regime that mandates extensive background checks and requires that guns be kept locked and unloaded. There are no comparable open carry laws in the country. Gun owners must be licensed, and all handguns and most semi-automatic weapons must be registered with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Ken Price, a gun control advocate whose daughter Samantha was injured in a 2018 mass shooting in Toronto that killed two and left 13 injured, said, "When you consider us next to the United States, which is so heavily armed that it's almost unbelievable, we look purportedly good. But compared to other democratic countries, there is much more we could be doing to address gaps in the system." And the 2020 Nova Scotia shooting joined a list of incidents proving that even Canada's restrictions haven't shielded it entirely from the horrors of gun violence. In 1989, a gunman targeted women at Montreal's École Polytechnique, killing 14 and wounding another 14. A 2017 incident, a young man entered a Quebec City mosque with a semi-automatic rifle and a pistol, killing 6 and injuring 19. Even the man behind the Toronto van attack that left 10 dead was inspired by an American mass shooter. Canadian officials claim, unlike tragedies in the United States of America, these events are largely isolated and have prompted changes to the country's firearms rules. An MP claimed after the massacre at École Polytechnique, Parliament passed laws that led to the creation of a nationwide gun registry. And Trudeau's ability to ban certain weapons with little political opposition highlights the different way guns are perceived by much of the Canadian public. Ju-Yong Lee, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Toronto Center for the Study of the United States, said the Second Amendment plays a big role in the arena of U.S. public discourse. Americans in general are suspicious of the state restricting their freedoms or telling them what they can and what they cannot do. But advocates like Price say gaps in the Canadian system remain, allowing events like the Nova Scotia shooting to happen.
Neighbors had previously raised concerns over the behavior of shooter Gabriel Wortman to the point that police had previously investigated him. Officers also knew he had a history of domestic abuse and owned a number of firearms. Price said, "You don't just need legislation to tell you what kinds of guns and ammunition you can own. You can also need institutions to have the ability to educate and to intervene." Adding, "Police should be able to move swiftly and take weapons away when they suspect they are at risk." And while the headlines often focus on mass shootings, the majority of shootings in Canada involve handguns in large urban centers. Lee said the bulk of the incidents are happening in racially marginalized communities. So in Canada, marginalized people bear the brunt of gun violence, just like they do in the United States of America. A recent survey found that a majority of Canadians, particularly those in urban centers, worried gun violence was increasing in their communities, a reality reflected in data from Statistics Canada. Firearms incidents in 2020 were double that of 2010. While straw purchasing and gun store theft are a problem in Canada, the gun that wounded Price's daughter was stolen from a location halfway across the country. Experts say a significant number of firearms come into Canada illegally across the border from the United States of America. Lee said, "Increasingly, in many ways, America's gun problem is becoming Canada's gun problem," adding, "Even though the U.S. has become an international poster child of gun control law, Gunari, there is a lot more commonality here in Canada than people might be willing to admit."
Yani.
Bazaar.
Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today, we'll venture through Iran's oil and gas industry. This sector is massive, and its enormity doesn't quite sink in until you visit one of the industry's annual exhibits. So, we visited the country's 26th International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition, dubbed the Iran Oil and Gas Show. We'll explore this sector's development and uncover why it's essential to the national economy. What are we waiting for? Let's get to it.
The Oil and Gas Show is one of the largest exhibitions in the global oil industry. It takes place every year and serves as a place for domestic and foreign industry participants to interact. The exhibition is based on the theme of knowledge-based oil, Iranian production, and global exports.
It is based on this year's economic goal set by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has emphasized strengthening the knowledge-based economy by adopting a scientific and technical approach in all fields. The exhibition showcases the latest products made by Iranian knowledge-based firms. It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. We caught up with a few participants to see what types of products and services they offered in this sector. This company manages an entire oil field in southern Iran. Moreover, it engineers machines and compressors needed for refining and processing crude oil and gas products.
Petro Iran Development Company, Petco, is one of the subsidiaries of NIOC, and we are acting as an ENP and GC contractor, and we are involved in several upstream and downstream projects, mainly in Iran and even abroad. The 26th oil and gas show was one of the biggest show during the past even 10 years. As I noticed during these 3 days, there were very good participation of foreign companies. And these foreign companies, it was my surprise that they are not seeking for individual work by themselves. They are looking for cooperative joint ventures with Iranian companies, and because we have a very good capable Iranian manufacturers and contractors, and I have seen lots of agreements that have been signed during these 3 days. There are very big opportunities for investment in Iran because of nowadays situation in the world. There are a very massive request, demand for Iranian oil and Iranian industry, manufacturers and contractors. And as it was noticed in this fair, more than 8 billion euros of investment agreement was signed. And I think that we have this opportunity to up to 20 billion euros of investment to sign with the Iranian and even foreign countries.
Another pavilion displayed the cutting-edge technology used in downstream and upstream oil industries. This company is also developing various oil fields and supplying electrical power.
Each year, scores of people and industry participants visit and hold pavilions in this exhibit. Such events also provide unique access to leading decision makers in the oil and gas industry. Additionally, it is a place for knowledge exchange and determining current needs and future development vectors. This year, the fair opened with 1,200 Iranian and 44 foreign exhibitors from 11 countries.
Another benefit of the fair is networking and creating new business opportunities throughout the energy sector with prospective business agreements. A significant number of business deals were closed during the 3-day oil and gas show. There is a lot of potential for investment in the oil and gas industry. This exhibit provides chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in this field. It's noteworthy that 23 universities and research centers and over 100 knowledge-based companies, startups, and technology parks participated in this event. High-profile representatives of foreign companies from 22 countries were present at the show too. The most notable was the Secretary General of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, Mohammad Hamal. Other important figures included the Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, Parliament Speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and the Head of Parliament's Energy Committee, Feridun Hasanvand. The sprawling fairgrounds were packed with all sorts of equipment and machinery used in the oil and gas industry. These ranged from advanced technology for extraction, processing, storage, transport, safety systems, and control technology. We spoke with a representative of a company specializing in producing composite pipes, which are high in demand in this sector.
Iran's oil and gas industry is thriving and has taken giant strides in production. It owes its many successes largely to knowledge-based companies and research institutions that have offered their services in developing this sector. Expanding the gas and oil industry has been at the top of the government's agenda for years. Over time, it has implemented several measures to this end. The government is focusing on knowledge-based firms and research companies as the bedrock of developing the oil and gas sector. The Oil Ministry has outlined several goals to tap into the high capacities of knowledge-based firms to boost production in the oil and gas sector. These goals are optimizing production, overhauling production facilities, and value chain developments. This goes hand in hand with the domestic development of innovative technologies. So, the government is supporting knowledge-based firms and startups and their efforts to manufacture commodities and equipment required in the oil and gas industry. Finding investors, whether domestic or international, is a top priority for the government. Iran is rich with oil and gas reserves and is the fourth largest oil producer among OPEC members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. So it's not surprising that the government would want to find ways to exploit its potential. The Oil Ministry has inked 50 agreements and memoranda of understanding worth nearly $17 billion in the first 9 months of last year alone. These deals were with petrochemical holdings, banks, and negotiating with reputable international companies. The agreements mainly focus on developing joint oil and gas fields, flare gas collections, and developing value chains. It plans on using knowledge-based companies and domestic manufacturing potentials to this end. The Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, says exhibits like the Oil and Gas Show reflect Iran's capability and authority despite sanctions. Oji also explains that Iran's gas and oil sector is steadily inching forward and is proving the failure of the US sanction policies. The official highlighted that the Oil and Gas Show displays the country's resiliency and its ability to diversify its economy through energy diplomacy. The minister expressed optimism for the future of this industry as there are grounds for returning to the energy trade. Oji says this can happen through gas swap deals, finding new markets for oil and its byproducts, and exporting technical engineering services. All things considered, there is a bright future for Iran's oil market and industry. Plus, it offers numerous lucrative investment opportunities in downstream and upstream sectors. The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more. This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole. Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery.
Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company, but this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth.
As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here.
Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands.
Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban, as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances.
Well, it looks like it's time for me to take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Water. It's a vital liquid for every life form on planet Earth. We drink it to quench our thirst, but is that the only use? Well, let me tell you that it is not. We can use it in different industries, such as oil and gas, petrochemicals. And today we are here at a company that works in different areas, like the ones that I mentioned. And one of the things that they produce is related to the water industry.
Atiye Pardozan Sharif Company was established 11 years ago. It's active in key industries such as oil and gas and petrochemicals. They have also managed to cooperate with power plants and steel industry companies. This group has sufficient experience and expertise in designing, optimizing, and manufacturing electrolyzers, as well as designing and creating chlorine plants for seawater and saltwater systems. They have provided jobs for 170 individuals directly and some 200 people indirectly. Using the scientific capital of the graduates of top universities and the experience of skilled specialists in the oil and gas industry and water and wastewater process units in the field of design, construction, installation, pre-commissioning and full operation of electrochlorination units in marine catchments, water and wastewater treatment plants, power plants, petrochemicals and domestic and foreign refineries, this company is very experienced.
Okay, raw material is brought into the company, then they turn them into things such as plates that are assembled in the line. Now, when the assembly is done, what you see is a seawater electrolyzer cell. Where we use it, I will explain it for you a little bit later. After that, all these things are transferred to protective shields. What do they do? Actually, they protect that equipment. After that, they are transferred to another section for packaging and shipping. So let's go and find out more.
Electrochlorination is the electrolysis of saline water inside an electrolyzer by the application of an electric current. The electrolyzer consists of a set of electrodes in which seawater flows. In this process, chlorine gas is produced at the sodium hydroxide cathode. Sodium hydroxide and chlorine gas then react with each other to form sodium hypochlorite solution.
The final part. Everything is ready for shipping. Something very important about this company is that these products are all produced from 0 to 100 in Iran. They transfer water from Persian Gulf, for instance, to provinces with dry climate, and this helps to disinfect water. until a couple of years ago, Iranian companies had to import these equipment. But now, thanks to this company, they can buy it at a very good price and use it in their companies.
The research and development unit of the company has been using the latest scientific findings of the world and constantly observed latest technology production trends to improve industry's unit's performance. As a result, they have managed to introduce several knowledge-based technologies to the market to solve the problems of industrial units.
Okay, I was talking to an expert in this lab. What do they do here? Well, after research and development and production, they take samples from the final products and test their quality because they do pay attention to details. I guess that's the end of today's report. Thank you.
Many thanks for that awesome adventure. We learned a lot from that. We still have a bit of time left, though, in the program, so let's look at some news and trends in Iran's gas and oil sector. Here we go. Iran's gas distribution network is quite advanced and has a very high capacity for transferring this hydrocarbon. Currently, the country is set to swap gas with its neighbours to the north.
Iranian officials are in talks with Turkmenistan to exchange gas and transmit Turkmenistan's gas through Iran to Armenia. Meanwhile, Iran presently has an electricity swap deal with Armenia. Under this contract, Iran sends gas bought by Armenia to generate electricity that is then exported to Iran when needed. Iran also sends electricity to Armenia via two transmission lines during the country's winter peak use. Iran enjoys the largest high-pressure gas pipeline network after Russia and can play a key role in transferring gas. The Ministry of Oil has already announced its willingness to start swapping oil and gas with countries around the Caspian Sea.
Among the goals of the Ministry of Oil is to raise the quality of oil refineries while increasing the industry's production capacity to 1.5 times over the next 5 years.
Officials with the ministry say development programs are underway to bring the refining capacity of crude oil and gas condensate to nearly 4 million barrels per day. Production figures presently stand at over 2 million barrels per day. However, current productions are still well below the average recorded output before the illegal US sanctions were imposed. The ministry has identified several investors who have signed agreements with the oil ministry. Their capital will be used in generating and developing refining capacities. Last year, Iran managed to export 1 million barrels per day.
Well, that wraps up our program for today. Thank you for tuning in. I have been Samson Seas, Captain of the Seven Seas. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.